You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au. Every once in a while, things come up that don't fit into one's preaching plan. Sometimes there's a pastoral urgency to addressing breaking events that it's my job to make sense of by inflecting them through the lens of Unitarian Universalism as I understand it. So I shelved the service I'd finished Thursday, replaced by what's going to follow this brief preface. As an American working in Unitarian ministry here in a country with sane gun laws, because of where I am and where I'm from, I was asked by the UUA at very short notice to address the Las Vegas shooting, as they felt I was in a singularly useful position to contribute to their advocacy for gun control. I felt and feel that this is the case. Helping the larger offices of the church was more my job than polishing the service I'd been writing for you, which is what I do with my Fridays. And you'll get it next week anyway. So there's not much funny in this today. So at least I'm consistent in that, right? To help understand why this particular massacre, and there is an average of one mass shooting per day in the U.S., this being the worst, why this calls for special attention, do this. Hold your two fingers up at arm's length from you, like this. That tiny space represents 1 degree of arc at the shooter's distance from the crowd. That is the space the shooter had to maintain during the discharge of thousands of high-velocity rounds. If he shot outside that 1 degree window at the angle and distance he was, he'd have missed the entire crowd. They'd have been outside the field of fire, the beaten ground, as the Army calls it. This tiny gap he had to maintain for a considerable period of time with a powerful weapon kicking against him as it poured 8 rounds a second, into the beaten ground. So he could not target individuals, but only the human mass itself. And at that rate of fire, these weapons heat up. The barrel expands, the bullets lose their grip on the rifling and thus their spin, and thus their fine accuracy over distance, and they tumble randomly rather than maintain trajectory. They can hardly be counted on to hit the opposing wall. So he had to know exactly when to change weapons for maximum effect, which he did, swiftly and surely, and from an enormous arsenal. All this technical information means he had to be more than deliberate. He had to be highly trained, well prepared, fully determined, and meticulous as a surgeon. This shooting was not wild, not half-cocked, not a heat-of-the-moment spray spree. It was calculating, as cold as ice. And he was not suffering from mental illness, as we currently understand it. What is this, if not the very definition of evil? Something we Unitarians find it hard to talk about. I don't mean he is evil. No one is born inherently with the will to do this. You have to be taught, enabled, encouraged. Evil exists in and as the systems that shape people and their choices, in unjust and often plainly irrational legal systems that ban lawn darts and not automatic weapons, by mediated propaganda systems that spread intentionally misleading memes like this: guns don't kill people, people kill people. By political systems that run on money. By financial systems driven by nothing than pure ravening corporate greed and the influence money can buy. And by cultural narratives soaked in and glorifying violence and aggression. Systemic evil embedded in social, political, cultural, and economic systems is harder to see and hold to account than a lone killer. But address such evil we must, or lose the name and the role of church. Anyway, here's what I wrote for the largely American audience of the UUA about what it's like being here in Australia with our gun laws. It's called Almost No One Here Is Armed. Current Australian gun laws introduced in 1996, as well as their clear effects on suppressing gun-related violence, are frequently cited by gun control advocates in the USA. These laws and their effects were achieved in the wake of the Port Arthur shooting, when a lone, white, male, armed with a stockpile of automatic weaponry, went on a rampage, shooting up a quiet Tasmanian tourist town, killing 35 and wounding 4. Here, down under, such a scenario is more the stuff of nightmares, less the stuff of the nightly news. The laws introduced by the then Liberal National Party coalition government, note, for liberal, read conservative here, don't ask me why, were sweeping in scope, aimed at a total prohibition on the ownership, possession, sale, and importation on all automatic and semi-automatic firearms. These laws were enforced by a six-month amnesty, during which time the owners were invited to sell unregistered or otherwise to-be-banned weapons back to the government, which in turn destroyed the surrendered guns. 650,000 were turned in. Failure to comply would mean tough penalties, including jail time. Included in the raft of legislation was a national gun registry, stricter guidelines for licensing and training, and an education program. There are still occasional amnesties and buybacks for unregistered and illegal guns. A recent one saw 30,000 surrendered. By and large, the legislation was passed as writ. Such was the national shock and horror at the Port Arthur massacre. The LNP government saw the political capital in the tragedy, the public mood, and the public benefit, and acted swiftly and decisively under the strong leadership of Prime Minister John Howard. As an indisputably direct result of this legislation, homicides fell by 59% and gun-related suicides by 65%. There had been 13 mass shootings in the 18 years preceding Howard's gun laws. There have been no mass shootings since. Such events as Las Vegas or Port Arthur simply do not happen here anymore. More than those statistics is the freedom one feels here. Freedom from random gunfire. Freedom from being torn apart by high-velocity rounds, blithely squeezed off by someone having a very bad day. Australians can go to any large event, walk on a crowded street, study on a busy campus, or catch mass transport, and it will never occur to them that more than half the people around them are strapped and loaded. Because they aren't. Only the cops are packing. So, to sum up, a mass shooting, a shocked nation, strong, decisive leadership, comprehensive, practical action by legislators and law enforcement. These events combine to produce unarguably positive results for Australia. If you sense some buts coming, you're right, and here they are. First, the legislation was initially opposed by a significant slice of the National Party, part of the Liberal National Coalition government that generally represents the interests of farmers. Australia is still a frontier economy based on primary production, and weapons are part of every farmer's toolkit. While it is true that you don't need an AR-15 to deal with the feral pest control of foxes and dingoes that attack grazing stock, nor to control native grazing animals like kangaroos, farmers find semi-automatic rifles pretty useful in management of threats to grazing and growing. There is still among farmers a strong resentment to control such weapons, and corresponding pressure on National Party and some independent senators to soften the laws. Second, Australians continued to buy guns since 1996. In fact, there are now more privately owned guns than there were in 1996, although with population increasing, per capita rates are significantly lower than they were before the legislation. As gun technologies change, as wealth from pressure groups like the NRA are deployed internationally, the Australian government will need to be vigilant to resist pressure groups, keep effective laws in place, and toughen them where needed. The past 10 years, however, has seen much leadership instability, 5 changes of prime minister, minority and coalition governments, and wafer-thin majorities. Swift, decisive, unilateral leadership may be becoming a fond memory in the sunburned country. Third, the NRA has Australia in its crosshairs. Since Australia is upheld as a model for effective gun control, the NRA has pushed back with propaganda ads full of outright lies about the country, that the populace are in revolt against gun control, that only criminals here have guns, that we are suffering under Big Brother socialism, etc., etc. You know the tune. But you wouldn't know these are false if you are a geographical and cultural distance from here. The NRA are coming for our guns, Australia, and they want to hand them back to us. But think of the profits. Fourth, John Howard was no saint. Howard, along with Bush and Blair, was arguably guilty of war crimes in his fervent and active support of the wars of the past decade. While genuinely and visibly shocked, appalled, and angered into action over local white deaths in a tourist town, Howard had not the least compunction about the necessary collateral slaughter of Iraqi or Afghani civilians and their children, and still does not. The gun laws may be his one triumphant legacy. Fifth, Australians have no right to feel smug about what its gun laws have achieved. They may express bewilderment at a culture with such a huge pathology, an average of one mass shooting a day, that could be so easily solved with such comparatively straightforward solutions. However, Australia as a country is in denial about its own violent pathologies, namely, the internationally condemned disgrace of our punitive, inhumane, militarized, and torturous asylum seeker policies, the systemic oppression of Indigenous Australians evidenced in low mortality rates and high incidence of Aboriginal deaths in custody, an epidemic of domestic violence in a hyper-masculine culture, and the gleeful cashing in on fossil fuel resources at a time of rising temperatures, rising sea levels, and climate-related deaths. But I, too, grow sick and tired and heartsick at naming these things, even to Americans who might benefit from our successes and mistakes. So listen to this. It's from Unitarian poet and hymnodist Lynn Unger. I'm tired of praying. Whoever hears my prayers is not the murdered, the flooded, the victims of fire and famine and war. No praying unless accompanied by food or water or a casserole or a hug. I'm tired of talking. Yes, even me. I'm tired in my soul of the truth's impotence, of how badly we all listen, of how language builds a fortress. No more talking unless you will tell me the story of your broken heart. I am even tired of solutions which are never enough and never actually solve the problem which, it turns out, those in power didn't really ever want to solve. No solutions unless they are stronger than the force of greed. Today, just for now, I only have time for choirs or dancing or trapeze, for actions in which we entirely depend on one another, actions in which we hold one another, in which we hold ourselves to the rigor of singing harmonies from the same song. Words of Lynn Unger. Here with an anecdote, I am a U.S. minister, U.S.-born minister serving here. I grew up in West Baltimore, The Wire, anyone? I left the U.S. as a young man in 1985, in part because I didn't want my children to grow up in a place where gunshots ringing out in the night were entirely normal, where their right not to be shot was trumped by everyone's right to own assault weapons, where the pathological addiction to weaponry and violent narratives was a normal fact of life. Yet these things, so bizarre to Australians, are entirely normal if you grow up in the States. My father was entirely normal and the most peaceful man you could know, and yet even he kept three weapons in the house. A Saturday night special six-shooter, a Mauser semi-automatic, and a pump-action shotgun. The shotgun was bought on the QT from a guy down at the plant. Soon after he bought it, he was showing it off to my elder sister one day. He demonstrated how you pump the stock to put one in the chamber and promptly blew a hole in the bedroom ceiling the size of a basketball hoop. Fortunately, my mother was not at home. He swore my sister to silence and, being a gifted handyman, got up in the loft and patched and painted the hole so you'd never know it was there. My sister kept this secret for over a generation until after he and mother had passed away. But if my sister's tender, beautiful face had been in the way of that dumb, atrocious accident, there could have been no denial, no secrets, no lies. That would be the sort of shame and horror that cripples families and ripples down generations. None of us, none of our children, or even their children, could have gone unaffected by it. The sins of the fathers, even my sinless father, do indeed get visited upon the children. I grieve for the victims of Las Vegas and their families and friends, but my heart breaks somehow more for the generations of kids yet unborn who will be born into a place as violent as the USA. As a nation, my country, my birth country, lost its crucial parenting moment at Sandy Hook. If a pile of bullet-riddled bodies of kindergartners and their teachers doesn't change the gun laws, I'm not sure if anything will. But the lies about guns, the secrets about the wealth and corruption that keeps guns firmly entrenched in our homes, and the denial that this is a national pathology must be called out. Called out now, and by those in a position to do something about it swiftly and decisively. I never thought I'd say this, but where is America's John Howard? U.S. leaders can begin by listening to voices outside the U.S. media bubble. Australia is not some other planet. It's very much like the U.S. And Australia is not alone in having effective gun legislation. Think you're exceptional, America? Well, apologies for salty language, but fuck your exceptionalism. Learn from us and from others before more innocent lives are mown down by this ongoing nightmare, this apocalyptic scythe that stalks your every home and street. So that's what I sent them. And to my astonishment, the UUA published it verbatim, salty closing language and all. Why is the UUA rising up and speaking out on this? How is it church business? Well, here are some reasons why on the screen. Where, indeed, is God or the good in all this? We find it where you'd expect, in human hearts, in thousands of people coming forth to offer a blood sacrifice, offering up their own blood to the good. Talk about a religious act. Even though all grisly martyrdoms must run their course, evil rarely gets the last word. When, after Jesus' gruesome and ultimately counterproductive martyrdom was done and his body entombed, two female disciples visiting the tomb found the stone rolled away, and when they entered, they did not find the body of Jesus. While they were wondering about this, suddenly two men in clothes that gleamed like lightning stood beside them. In their fright, the women bowed down with their faces to the ground, but the men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? Why do you look for the living among the dead? He's risen. Go." When the world seems so very broken and done, I'm proud to speak for a church, a movement that wants to rise and go forth from the tomb as a living witness to keep hope alive, a church that shall rise and speak out to expose cultural diseases rather than the symptoms, a church that shall rise and speak out when the death grip of greed chokes life and living, a church that shall rise and speak out when our leaders fail us or are bought or don't even try, and a church that shall rise and speak out and sing out and shout out when other hope-filled people emerge from their grief into the light, as they will, as they always have. So death shall have no dominion if you take steps from death toward life. This means we must do more than offer thoughts and prayers. We have to work to call out and confront those powers and systems that cheapen, degrade, and destroy life. I bury 6 years in the role of minister today. So as I embark today on what will be the next and probably last term of my ministry here, please do us both a wee favor during these coming years. Don't tell me church shouldn't address politics. It's part of my job. It used to be said in the old days that you were supposed to preach with the Bible in one hand and a newspaper in the other. Well, absent the Bible, and you're left with the newspaper. Like all of my UUA colleagues, I want to preach from an open heart and an informed and thinking mind, engaged in Le Monde, the world, broken and hopeless though it may seem. May all the gods and none give me strength to do so. And may they give you the will and grace to bear that with me as we rise and go forth. Amen. Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.